Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. I've just about unpacked everything from Grogmeat, which at the time of recording took place last month in January 2025. It was delayed from November last year due to the MTV Awards being held in Manchester. It was a great weekend, and later in this episode I'll be joined in the Zoom of role-playing rambling by our resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, so we can have a post-mortem on our experiences of what we played and what we thought of the time that we had. It always goes far too quickly. Anyway, this year, our guest of honour was Paul Budowski, who's been on the podcast before talking about paranoia. But this time, we're catching up with him after a few productive years. Paul is an explosion of ideas and gaming inspiration. It was good to chat to him on the Sunday morning of Grogmeat about his revival of a little play game from Gary Gygax, his experiences in play by mail back in the day, and projects that have been developed and released since we last spoke. The D Sanction is a great premise, and it's one of the many that are in the Baldowski brain box. Listen as we unlock some of the delights within over this grog pod. Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Hello, my name's Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. And I'm coming live from Fanboy 3, and I'm completely and utterly surrounded by the Grog Squad. Hello, Grog Squad! Hooray! And on my left, I have Paul Baldowski. Hello there, Paul.
Hello there.
And on my right, I have the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Monroe. Paul, would you like to give it a tap?
I absolutely would. Where would you like me to tap it?
That's up to you, wherever you feel comfortable. Okay, let's have a seat. The Eternal Champion. She's appeared as herself. Oh. A rare manifestation. It was actually the Eternal Champion's birthday last Thursday. And here is a picture on here that my daughter did. My daughter's 18 now, but when she was 4, we were obsessed with Sinbad, you know, the Golden Voyage of Sinbad. And this is a drawing that she did of Caroline on her birthday. We sent an email to her and showed her the picture. And said, maybe someday she can come to a convention and I'll sign it for her. Ever the professional.
Yeah.
That'll be £15. But I think it's only right we should sing happy birthday to the Eternal Champion. One, two, three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, the Eternal Champion. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you for indulging me in that. So, Paul, you've been running games in Grogmeat. How's that gone for you?
It was really good. It was, I always consider Grogmeat an opportunity to run the games that never get run.
Yes.
And yesterday was very much a case of that. One was, I haven't run it despite owning it for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Which was Dangerous Journeys, Gary Gygax's last flaming hope, which ultimately burnt down to ashes, taking Games Designer Workshop with it. But that was entertaining, an incredibly complex game.
Tell us a bit more about the history of that. So, because I've heard people talk about it.
Yeah.
That, it's D&D, but everything renamed, is that the idea? Or avoiding copyright infringement?
Kind of. By no means a gaming historian. Gary Gygax had his ties cut, the bridges burnt with TSR, the legal bodies had leapt in, and he went, and so Dangerous Journeys, I'm not sure it's necessarily D&D reimagined. The game itself, the Mythos engine, was meant to be like a generic engine to, on which things could be built. I think Dangerous Journeys overall was that, that was the idea behind it. The first game he did was this effectively an alternate world fantasy setting. And he'd written a whole bunch of books for it. There's a core book, there's a magic book, there is one about this alternate Earth. Obviously, every time an E is in the game, it's suddenly got an A in front of it as well. So there's Earth with an A in the front and Egypt with an A in the front. Whatever the term for that particular character is. And so there were like five books, I think, pretty much written. And then TSR came along and said, on top of all the other things you can't do any fantasy games. That's all part of this agreement. So, and unfortunately, the first game, Dangerous Journeys, was exactly the thing he wasn't allowed to do. And they'd invested all this money in. And so, yeah, it ultimately was kind of his swan song. But unfortunately, it probably took Games Designer Workshop with it as well. So,
And what's it like to play? Is it worth reviving? Because some of these games that you put the defibrillator on, you sometimes come away with a headache and not much enjoyment.
No, this is all headaches, really.
Right.
What I ran yesterday was called Mythos Prime, which is kind of like the D&D to the AD&D, where the game uses the same terminology. It doesn't use the same numbers in the background. So if you run it as I did, the adventure I was running was written for the full fat version of Dangerous Journeys. I was using the skimmed milk version. You have to actually work everything out. Like, stats are halved, so skills are 75%. It's not even just halving everything. There's like formulas almost in the background. Ignore this bit, ignore that bit. And, but the actual main version of it is just really complicated. You know, you've got a physical stat, but then you've got three substats, which are like capacity, and I don't even remember what they were, but you end up with, you've got physical, spiritual, and mental, and they've all got three substats. And then you don't have skills. You have knowledge/skills, and each of them is broken down into something called a steep, which I can't now even remember. Study, teaching, education, something.
Sounds amazing.
It's the book has got a 4-page glossary slash abbreviation section at the end. There is 1 page of acronyms. And fundamentally, as you're reading through it, you're going, no, Gary, I know what you were writing about here. And then you chose to give it a new name because you were sidestepping it. So it's horrific. I'm going to run it out a few more times this year, but that's purely because I'm a masochist, I think.
And your second game was a bit...
Second game was Savage World,
yeah,
which I have owned for a little while, read several times, but never run. So I had a go at that. I think it worked okay. You'd have to talk to my players in that respect. But that's just one of the games where it's a common sort of game. Game masters always have something they fall back on if they want to run something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'll use a core rule system. And Savage Worlds is one of those examples. But I've never quite grokked it in terms of why it's a fallback for people, because it has always come across as a little bit tactical, crunchy. Maybe it's got measurements in it, and
lots of little subsystems.
It's got a raft of modular bits and pieces. So even I'd read the adventure. I ran an adventure, pre-written one yesterday, and there were several times during it where it said, like, run this as a dramatic encounter. And I'm going, what does that mean? that was another experience. And I'm going to run that out a few times this year and sort of cross those firmly off my list one way or another.
Yeah. As somebody who does use Savage Worlds as a kind of go-to system.
Yeah.
It does take a few run outs, I think, to get your head around it and master it and feel confident about it. The other bit, taking it to conventions is a commitment, because so many bits.
Yes.
Yeah. So many bits of bling to it.
Yeah.
Good. That's good. I was running a game set in my game world of Racklash I created with Blythe and Ed when I was 16, Postal Game.
Mm.
And I know that you have got a similar experience with PBMs. Yeah. You run a PBM. So tell us about that.
I think I was probably a little bit earlier, only ever so slightly, maybe 14 or 15.
Prodigy. Yeah.
Yes. but so my map, and I can't honestly remember the name of the, it was like a region of a larger map. Mm. And it was a geography. Piece of geography homework I was supposed to be doing. and this piece of geography homework turned into this map that effectively filled, I don't even know what size it works out, probably an A2 sort of map. It's not quite that. It's like several square pieces of paper, all taped. They were all taped together. and the more I drew, the more it's got contours. And oh, everything. Wow. Yeah. I think that got me extra point.
Yeah.
On the back of the map, my geography teacher wrote how impressed he was with the detail and gave me five endeavors, which was like, you'd normally get one endeavor.
It wasn't Gary Gygax, was it?
No, no. But he, you'd get this little slip which showed you'd got an endeavor or something. Mm. I got five endeavors for this one map. But so that map then became the basis for what was called Darklands. So that was Darklands was the first play by mail, and I cannot for the life of me work out why I started running it. I think maybe it was all those classified ads in White Dwarf. It was looking through White Dwarf. Not only were there adverts, full adverts for these terribly professional sounding companies. But there was the likes of you and I in the classified section. And so I advertised, would anyone like to play this Darklands game? I'd typed it on the old manual typewriter. It runs about 50 pages of A4. I think it grew over time. So the more I ran it, the more detail was added. So people who were playing it would get a copy of this rule book. And I dread to think how little I probably charged for it. It was probably just to cover the photocopying costs from going down the library.
Yeah.
First one. And it probably had a couple of dozen players, which is not much, but it ran for, it ran for a few years.
It can take over your life.
So, because I didn't type the responses. They were all handwritten.
Yes.
And probably ran to maybe a side or two of A4 of handwritten sort of story.
And I don't know about your players, but they were terribly keen, weren't they? So you kind of get through a batch of them, send them off, I think, man. God, for that next day, they'd be back. It never ends.
Yeah. I mean, part of the contract with the players was a self-addressed envelope, a stamped self-addressed envelope, or else you're not getting a response from me. And I think it was maybe just like £1 or £1.50 or something. It wasn't much per turn. And it went up a little bit over time. But you're right.
You mean expensive. I charged 10p.
10p?
Yeah.
The technology did develop over time. I started using carbon paper.
Oh.
Purely because otherwise I couldn't remember what I'd already done. I mean, otherwise it ends up like one of those, sort of ongoing narrative. It would be an ongoing narrative where I'd have to remember what happened last year or the year before. Because some of the players did run their characters. I think the longest running one went to about 40 or 50 turns.
Right. Wow.
But during that time, I started then running other games. Yeah. So Darklands was the first one. Then there was one rather imaginatively called Dark Hope, which was a science fiction game. To the Stars was a corporate cyberpunky, vaguely exploration game. Mm. And then Nexus were a bunch of war games where I started writing sort of you have a civilization and you got, you need to develop your military, diplomatic and whatever structure. And so, I just got into this business of writing one game after the other, which seems to have carried on to now in its own way, but I'm not quite as prolific as I probably was when I was a teenager.
And did you retain, have you still got all that stuff?
I've got a lot of the rule books. Yeah. I would have bought them in, but I have this vision that some of them now need the repair shop to get the conservator in to, you know, to strengthen up some of the so the paper. So like I still have the original Darklands rulebook, which I note, as said, it definitely was modular because you can see where I used a different paper to add elements to it. And then the whole thing was taken to a photocopier and I just copy it off. But yeah, I have a lot of it.
So I've revived my game world. Are you tempted to bring yours back to life?
No. I mean, there's potential to maybe use the map, probably as the basis for drawing a new map. But I think it was, I think as a storytelling experience, it was very reactive, which is probably why it grew as well. So bouncing off, it was interesting to bounce off all these players, and each of them would bring their own character to it, their personality to it, their ideas. And I would take elements of that and sort of bind them into the world. There is a lot of world building in there, but probably I don't think I'd necessarily want to revisit it.
I know that you're a prolific reader and do lots of research. When I look at the D-Sanction, I remember that you used to send images of piles of books that you were using as research. So where do you start on something like that, and how do you get that inspiration from history?
I think I've fooled you. I'm a prolific buyer of books.
Oh, yeah.
my assumption is that I can absorb some of the knowledge purely by sitting close to it. But normally, I am, in my opinion, a really slow reader. Right. So what I will normally do is there will be something that triggers. There will be a trigger point, a catalyst to an idea. I will have read something in one book, and I will try and research around it. And oddly as it might seem, it's odd to buy them. It's a bit like the experience of going into a bookshop and buying a horrible histories book seems a bit odd, but it's normally a good place to start, because if you start with like a horrible histories, if you're going to do historical gaming, it's either that or a GURPS supplement. So, you know, where you're going to go. It's useful to start small and just sort of build out from it. So, you know, whatever the case, like recently doing a supplement, which was based in early Victorian periods, was exactly that sort of situation. You know, each person will have a certain amount of history that they know, or think they know, but I find it useful to go to literally almost a horrible histories or a child, a school level sort of textbook, because they're, not only the simplification, but you'll have a lot of information crammed into small sections. So you can just pick out where everything was, what the state of technology and so forth was, and then just build out from there. Because otherwise you end up with stacks and stacks of books, which you never read.
So you talk about a spark. So what was the spark for the D-Sanction? And for those who don't know D-Sanction, just what's the pitch for that?
So the pitch for D-Sanction is it's our world, but the common fears, concerns, and sort of outcry about the ideas of the supernatural and magic, which at the time would have been an excuse to say, you know, something's gone wrong, we'll blame it on magic and the person in the village that we don't like, which unfortunately went all the way up to the court level. You know, the queen and the courtiers would potentially have had these thoughts as well. The idea is that magic does exist, but it has, up until King Henry VIII, it's been held in check by the faith and the belief of the population. And then Henry knocks all the monasteries down, effectively sort of rampages across the country, takes all the treasure, kicks out all the monks and the other people in these places, and it weakens the sort of fabric of our reality, allowing bad things to creep through. And so John Dee, who is the Queen's advisor, alchemist, astrologer, and all sorts of general polymath, in the game, convinces her that there is a need to protect the newfound sort of British Empire. And so at the time, you would basically, there were a bunch of acts of Parliament which said, if you use magic, you'll be punished, often tortured, sometimes killed. And Dee says, no, why kill people? We can use them as our tools. So within the game, players are those tools. They are agents of D who participate in something called the D sanction, which is a adjustment to the 1563 or 4. I trip over this one. Act of against witchcraft, enchantment, and conjuration, which basically said if you use magic, you will be potentially killed. And so the D sanction is an adjustment to that act.
And that was only repealed in the '50s, wasn't it?
All sorts of things haven't been repealed yet. It got adjusted a bunch of times just in the 1500s.
Yeah. So, a bit like Dangerous Journeys.
So that's the idea behind the game.
The adventures. So the part of the thing, I pick up D-Sanction. This is an admission from me. I pick up a D-Sanction and I don't really know where to start. You know how sometimes you can quickly jot down some ideas for an adventure. So what can the players do? Where do you suggest we start? I've got my horrible histories. Where do I go? What kind of things can the players do?
Your last question actually was about the spark of it.
Yeah.
And so normally, bizarrely enough with D-Sanction, genuinely I think the spark was the name. I don't know why it came into my head.
Yeah.
But it seemed like an interesting name for a game. I don't know why it came into my head. I think I must have been reading about D for some reason. But that actually is also where you should start, I think, as a potential game master, is if you simply pick up, whether it's probably a book along from the Horrible Histories or looking at the Elizabethan court or John D as an individual, the court of Queen Elizabeth, full of chances, and D was kind of one of them, saying, I can turn lead into gold, or I can do something like that. And they would say, but I can only do it if you give me £10,000. And then what they actually tended to do is then go off, buy some gold, so that next time they went to court, they said, look, I've made gold.
Yeah.
Can you give me another £10,000? If you look at the kind of cons that people were getting up to, or the basis for the cons that they were pursuing, some of them would genuinely believe a little element of what they were doing, because otherwise they couldn't come across as honest or truthful. Looking at what they believed, the little elements of it, one of the adventures for the D-Sanction was sparked by the fact I read that there was a belief that the soul was embedded in the fingernails. Yes, somehow the fingernails were a reflection of your soul. And I just started reading around it and looking what other elements, why was this a belief? This was something tied up probably in some religious text that made a reference to something. And you just then allow yourself to rabbit hole, to spiral around the subject. And so, you know, another good source is Wikipedia and the like, if only because if you start reading around the subject, you'll inevitably find something you trip over, rabbit hole into, and then start, you know, your tumble down into one page after another of weird and wonderful theories and historical notes and things like that.
So I've got to look out for chances getting government contracts.
Yes. Yep, effectively.
Okay. I have to look for some inspiration for that. You've now taken the rule set, because just to talk about the rule set a little bit, made that generically available, so it's applicable to different settings. So how does sanction work, and what would you say are the three highlights of the rules? Judge Baldowski.
Oh, dear. What pressure. So to give you a little tiny bit of background, desanction as an idea came to me in 2014.
Hmm.
And I spent about 6 years after that running a lot of adventures without actually having a firm rule set. So at one point it used tokens and cards and It had various, there were variations on it that meant that I think one session I ran at a con, I actually gave up on the rules and just ran the adventure on the fly, with like, just rolling a die for like a 50-50 chance of success on things. Although actually I might have even forgone the die. When I was later on, when I was thinking more about the system, one thing I find quite interesting when I'm looking at systems is working out the sort of the most basic way of creating the same experience. So, you know, if we go back to Dangerous Journeys, for example, when you create a character, most of their skills are around the 50% mark. And yet Gary Gygax threw a D100 into it, a whole bunch of modifiers for what was effectively a 50-50 chance of success. And I think what I looked at and decided on was, well, isn't a really simple way of doing that almost flipping a coin or a four-sided die and in that case, why not just roll a four-sided die? What nuance are you expecting to find in rolling D100 if ultimately it's just 50-50? And so at the heart of the system, it is the idea was, if you throw a 50-50 on a D4, there's a one and a two is a fail, three and a four is a success. If you then step it up and you're slightly more skillful, you roll a D6 and the one and the two is still your failure. And so the bigger the die, you're just slowly incrementing above the 50 and the 60 and then 70, 80 and so forth. So weirdly enough, that's the core of the system. The idea is that most people have a 50-50 chance of success at the things that they're okay at. Because again, if you look at character sheets for lots of games, I'm sure you can think of some character sheets for certain games where you sit there, you have lots of skills which are moderately okay, and then you end up with a bunch of points at the end that you just assign to a few random skills on the off chance that you know, maybe one day you're going to need anthropology, so let's throw 3 points of skill into it and maybe we'll roll it. And it felt like that was a bit of an odd way to create a character. So the sanction system uses the approach that you're only the most key skills are the ones that make you shine as a character. And so when it comes to a challenge, a situation where you have to step up and do something to move the story along, those are the elements that your character actually comes to the fore. And you make, so you will only have a very small number of skills written down. The rest of them are those ones which on your game, your character sheet would have a few points in. The ones that we're interested in, the ones where you actually put the 50 or 60 or 70%, it means that the character generation process is far more straightforward. You just choose the three things you're really good at. Within the system itself, I use tables which create a very simple life path. So it's almost, what did you used to do? What changed? And what hobby do you have, for example? And you just roll on these tables and it offers you a selection of skills to choose from, and you choose three out of that. And that's what shows your character, what your character's good at and why they're good at it, because of what brought them into the situation they're in now. The bits that stand out for me for the system are, it's the focus on the characters. It's the fact that because the characters each have things that they are good at and can shine at, and which kind of automatically gives the players a bit of a spotlight, because they will be probably the only people who have a skill that relates to the situation. There's a simplicity to it. You can create characters very quickly. As a gamer, I have very rarely played a game long enough to be that concerned about the, you know, legacy of a character and, you know, worrying about reaching 20th level or whatever. And so for me, having characters that can just shine in the moment, are easy to create, that's important to me at least. And it means also, as a GM at conventions, it's a lot easier to be able to bring the game to the table because you can create the characters there and then, rather than pre-genning. You know, having that pre-generated character, you can bring blank character sheets and 5 minutes later, you've got a character on the table. Third thing that stands out.
But you
subtitle it a challenge-led game. So what do you mean by that?
So it connects into that opportunity for characters to shine in the moment. The fact that it is those skills are what makes your character stand out.
Right.
And so the challenges that they come up against, each person is sort of defined by their opportunities to meet those challenges.
Yeah. And you've produced some settings for it, haven't you?
Yeah.
So do you want to just run through a couple of those?
Yeah. I mean, this is probably where the PBM side of things comes in, notion of creating so many games. It for me sanctions an opportunity for my wayward brain to be able to create lots of material on lots of different things without too much focus. So amongst the settings so far, there is, for example, the one I mentioned before is Victorian game in the midst of shades, which basically takes the Victorian era and turns it on its head. Victorian era, lots of people believe in ghosts. There's this sort of view, it's sort of a romantic view of, media, people gathered around the table that, the medium reaching out to the spirit world. And in the midst of shades, it's the opposite way around. Nobody believes in ghosts, but they are very much real, and only the characters and a few others are actually aware that they exist, and it leads them into a situation where they are battling against these spirits that are not by no means at rest and have to be dealt with. But the people around them can't see the ghosts. They don't believe in the ghosts. And so the characters are challenged by, we're saving the world, but everyone's treating us like we're crazy. Yeah. They're Lost in the Folds, sort of vaguely science fiction. If you've, you are residents of an enclosed community, which seems to be completely contained within a space, but you don't really understand that you are enclosed. It's just the world that you're in. But that world is threatened by the fact that it's actually part of a network of similar communities. Mm. And the system that's running it basically has a really simple imperative that if something goes wrong, the best way to deal with it is to move the resources to the areas that are still working. And it does that by just cutting everything in half. It shuts down half of everything that's currently running and diverts all the resources. So the fold is literally, here's all the communities, something's going wrong over here, shut all those down, and it moves everything over. Oddly enough, the community you're in, for some reason the number of communities created was an odd number. So every time there's a fold, you are trapped in one of the fractional communities and you don't realize it. But that's creating all sorts of weird side effects in the world around you. Yeah, you have to read it to really get it.
Yeah.
In the sanctioned book, there's a setting called the Agency, which is my fascination in part with slow horses and Mike Herron's sort of espionage series, where you are playing members of the you're members of the factory, which is the slang term for the intelligence organization you work for, but you have done something wrong. You've messed something up. You miscalculated a spreadsheet. You didn't assign resources to an operation right, whatever. So you've been slung out into what's called a clearance outlet in a small town, expected to basically run the worst possible background admin jobs. And inevitably, though, you get drawn back into service by the fact that there's always something going on. And so the players are playing these somewhat failed agents who still have something to bring to the service. Yeah, that's been an interesting one to write without, it's meant reading lots of John le Carré and Len Dayton and so forth to get a bit of a background in the espionage side of things. So that's been fun to research.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that you're always producing. I bought one of Old Rolled Up's mystery boxes, and it contains everything you need to start playing,
yeah,
including a little scenario.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just on a page, a little game.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did it come from? Is it these, it's just like a fevered brain trying to grab hold of ideas?
I think fever brain would definitely be it. Yeah. I mean, if what you got was the all rolled up RPG, which is one of the things in the boxes. So it's just a matter of often having a little idea, something that I read, something that I've noticed, creating a game around it. In the case of the all rolled up RPG, I think literally Phil just said to me, I need something to put in one of these boxes. And I know, you know, if you go on online to Drive Through or Itch or whatever, it seems to be full of ideas that can be condensed down to a folding pamphlet sheet of, you know, paper. So it was kind of like the challenge. Can I come up with a fantasy game? I think in this case, that will fit on a single A4 sheet.
So you did it. So what's the current project? So is it still developing more sanction ideas, or are you going back to some of your other projects?
The key thing is what are the current projects? Because it's definitely a case of having, if I've only got one thing to work on, I will end up dead-ending myself and, staring at the computer or at a sheet of paper going, where's this going? How's this going to work out? So at the moment, Sanction has a few other settings that I want to develop. One of which, for example, is a prequel to the D-Sanction, which deals with that period when all the monasteries were being knocked down. But it's more like sort of treasure hunters going out and trying to get to the treasure before the king grasps all the valuables. And that's called Safety Lies in Fear. There is a science fiction game called Divided Horizons, which has been bubbling rather like D-Sanction did. I've got a rough idea of the system. I know broadly what the background is, and it's basically sort of a colony ship heading out into the universe and trying to find new worlds to inhabit, only to discover when they arrive at the first world that the drive system of the ship actually destroys the fabric of space. Because every time it's only been tested properly by sending ships out. And each time the ships have gone out, they've found out it starts to destroy the fabric of space. So you can't go home and tell them that the technology is destroying the universe. You have to find a way to actually solve the problem while you're out and about, or find a way to tell home through some other technology. So the idea of the game is that you've got a ship, it's got 100 colonists on it. Each of those colonists is a potential character for you to play. And it's a bit more like we're all red shirts here. Where, you know, you are probably going to die along the way, but you need to find a solution. If you don't find a solution, the campaign has an end point to it. Eventually, everybody dies on the ship. Slightly depressing, but you've reached the end of the campaign. Or you manage to find a way to communicate home. So I'm trying to get the sort of modular aspect of that together, the idea that you need to be able to gather and build up technology and keep a record of that. And at the same time, you can play all sorts of characters who are members of the crew without necessarily having a long-term sort of Captain Kirk type figure who's in charge of the ship. And D-Sanction, I am working on it's not a new edition. I'm not incrementing the number. I want to do another hardback version of it, similar to when I released it originally back in 2021. But I want to include more adventures and material in it because one challenge is reaching wider markets. At the moment, I mainly deal in quite terse, now, you know, short books, which have a lot of, you know, sort of basic ideas, simple systems. It's a lot harder to sell books like that when you go to a distributor in, say, America and say, can you distribute this for me? So I want D-Sanction to be a bigger, chunkier book with more material in it, in the hopes that it can potentially find a wider audience, because there's all these Renaissance fairs and people fascinated by, you know, the English in America. It would be nice to maybe see if I can sort of break more of the gaming market by coming up with a bigger, sort of splashier version of D-Sanction. So that's probably going to kickstart earlier. Sort of March, so this year. So I've got a lot of work to do, but I've already wrangled in some potential guest stars to do some adventures for that.
I'd find having some adventures for it useful, because I was saying earlier, it's just knowing where to start, and I think having the adventures would kind of kick it started.
To
make up ideas. So that's great. Well, thanks, Paul, for being here today, the interview. I think you're the embodiment of just get on and do it.
Oh, get me coat.
We're wandering towards the door. We've met up with our coats on, and we're not going to feel the benefit outside. It's quite cold. It's January, and we've had grog meat in January, so we're going to have a chat about that. Hello there, Blythe.
Hello there, Duck.
Yeah, you just caught me, actually. I was just having a read of it promises me, this article, that it cures eye bags. I'm just having a read of it.
Cures eye bags? What?
Eye bags, yeah.
Bags under your eyes?
Yeah, I suffer badly from bags under my eyes. But it's talk about tea bags and pillows and microdosing on Botox. I think that's beyond my...
You're going to
I might do the tea bags, but...
I think the answers were glasses. I think if you wear glasses, it masks them a little bit. Even though the glasses are transparent, it masks the eye bags a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, thanks.
Cheaper than Botox.
Thanks for the cosmetic advice. That's what people come for. But I was going to ask you, what were your highlights of grog meat this time?
My highlights? Well, in terms of games, I enjoyed it all. I ran some old school essentials in the Midlands, which I think was very enjoyable. Midlands is good, isn't it? The thing with old school essentials, I have a lot of time for old school essentials. I like it, but I do sometimes think it needs a bit of character injecting into it, because it can be a little bit bland, I think, on its own. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I played some Vesen, which I enjoyed, with Fun Fun Mike. But if I had highlights, I suppose, one highlight would have to be Gatsby and the Great Race, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The bonkers multi-table. I had no idea what was going on. Because I think what's interesting about it is, as a GM, you're running your table and one reality.
And we should describe explain what that is. Me interjecting in a Rory Stewart type way.
You should explain it. I'm assuming everyone knows what it is. Well, I'm always wary of giving any spoilers. I don't want to give out too many spoilers.
Yeah, we don't give away too much spoilers, but too many spoilers. But it's a multi-table adventure for Call of Cthulhu, which Paul Fricker, who was in attendance and had helped us to prepare for this, it's set in the 1920s. Great Gatsby, the character from the famous novel, is one of the characters, and the investigators are invited around to his house for a garden party. And that's kind of a mild-mannered summer's afternoon, which starts to go awry. And across the tables, there's a lot of moving of players around the room, going into separate rooms, encountering strange and wonderful experiences. So we had 40 players, and we had 7 tables. There was at least 6 additional keepers supporting the action. So how was it for you?
Bonkers. As I say, I think the interesting thing as a GM in it is you are running a table, which is, and again, it's not too much of a spoiler, this, but it's one reality of many, isn't it? One reality of many. And people are moved from one reality to another. And as you say, weird things happen in between. But as a GM, you don't really know what's going on anywhere else. So I think Graham landed at my table, and he looked to me for hints about what's going on. And I said to him, I don't know what's going on. I'm just running this world. Whatever's gone on in that room with a strange woman with a hooded cloak on is I have no idea. I have genuinely no idea. So I'm just running my reality, which is kind of weird, I suppose, kind of weird from a GM's perspective, because when you're a GM, normally you do know what's going on, don't you? Or at least you should. You know, the idea that you do know what's happening in its entirety, but in that, you don't.
No.
You don't know what's happened at the table they've come from, and you don't know what's happened when they've been whisked off into the netherworld and had this weird experience in a room. So they were coming to me with strange clues and ideas, but I had no idea what they were talking about, yeah. Which is it's a quite unique experience from a GM's perspective, I think. It didn't quite dawn on me until about two-thirds of the way through it, where I thought, well, actually, yeah, this is weird, because I know what's going on, I know the plot, and I know what the players have to do, but some of the things they're talking about and some of the stuff they're doing, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, but the golden rule, of course, of investigative games is normally say, don't throw in any red herrings, because the players will generate their own red herrings.
Yeah.
But when they're whisked away and they're travelling through a dimension into a different room, they're kind of bombarded with a sensory experience which gives them some clues to what's going on. It's got a vague resemblance to what's happening on the table. But I think what was happening is that people's imaginations were kicking in and they were making more of what was presented to them, as you naturally would.
Yes.
And the conjectures were presented to the GMs. And, of course, you were thinking, where the heck's that come
from? Where's that come from? Yeah, exactly. Where's that come from? The honey badger. Some guy followed it into the woods. It's totally meaningless. It's a waste of time. Yeah. No, it was great. It was a great experience. It was a really good experience, I think. Kind of, like I say, unique experience, really, both from the player's perspective and from the GM's perspective. I suppose my only regret was that as a GM, I couldn't play it. So people who were taken off into the strange locked rooms for a weird experience, of course, as a GM, you don't experience that. So,
It's an ambition of mine to have done it, and I'm so pleased that we did manage to do it, because you need to have certain conditions to be able to do it, and having a convention like we have the privilege to run is an ideal opportunity, isn't it, to do it. So I'm so pleased that we did it, because it was a unique experience, and Paul was explaining that it's never really been done at that scale that we did it, and it's thanks to the keepers, both who were running the tables and the extra keepers, that it did run. It was chaotic, but it was organised chaos. It was planned, and people knew what they were doing, sort of.
Well, everyone knew. Anyone running it, GMs, extra GMs, people in the netherworld, all knew what they were doing. But, of course, none of them had a complete overview of what was going on in any other area. And I think that's what created the chaos. But at the same time, it was organised, because everyone knew what their component, their bit was, if you know what I mean.
And I stood in the middle like a messianic megalomaniac coordinating.
You did, didn't you? Yeah, you enjoyed that, I think.
I did.
Yeah. Was that your highlight?
It was my
highlight. Yes, I'm sure.
I did resist the temptation on the instructions to put my role down as God.
Never stopped you before.
No, but it's I remember at the start of this, when we were briefing the keepers and we had a Zoom chat beforehand, didn't we? And I said, well, it's quite simple. And Paul Fricker said, no, it's not simple. But I think what I was trying to say was, once you've got that idea that you're just a cog in this process, and just concentrate on turning round your table, everything else will move.
Absolutely. That is exactly it. Every component part is simple, but when you add it together, it becomes very complicated. But the brilliance of it is, any one individual involved in it, running it at whatever level, it's quite easy. I found it quite easy to run, because it almost ran itself. But as you say, in a broader sense, it's quite complicated. For players, it's bewildering. but it's not bewildering for a GM. You just run your bit. The only bewildering thing is people saying weird things to you when they arrive at your table that you think, what are we talking about? No idea.
It's a great experience. Yeah, that's probably one of my highlights as well. So pleased that we managed to do it. And again, thanks to everyone who made it possible.
Mm.
So what else did you run then?
I ran Old School Essentials. I ran Doctor Who at MorpCon afterwards. I don't know if that counts because that's MorpCon, isn't it?
I think it does count.
But I played it. I think the other highlight was playing X-Crawl Classics. The new DCC variant with Debbie ran X-Crawl Classics.
Is that like a souped-up dungeon?
It's an odd idea. And when I first heard about it, I was, as I often am with almost everything, as you know, I was a bit sceptical. I was a little bit, what's this, It's like the idea where dungeons are a kind of spectator sport, like a gladiatorial spectator sport, like a Squid Game, I suppose, or something like that, or The Running Man, that kind idea. But the more I kind of discovered about it, it's kind of set in a futuristic America.
I assumed it was a fantasy variant, so it's not like a fantasy world.
It has fantasy in it, but I think the idea is that imagine the fantasy world of DCC, but the future happened. So there are elves and dwarves, but the future happened. As in there's elves and dwarves and there's magic, but there's also TV and mobile phones and cars and all sorts of other things. And it's like a bit of a Roman Empire, an American Roman Empire, where they have these gladiatorial dungeons that are designed to kill people. And they have these superstar dungeoneers who are like celebrities who go into these dungeons and try and survive for the entertainment of the masses. So it's like a dystopian future, I suppose, really.
Is it a player versus player, or are you cooperating?
Not really. It's more, I suppose you could do it like that, but it's more cooperative, really. But I suppose what's interesting about it is it's a conceit to avoid the question of why is there a dungeon here and everything having to make sense, because I suppose like when people design dungeons, you always go down the road, there's going to be some guards, there needs to be a barracks where the guards sleep, and there needs to be somewhere where the guards eat, isn't that, we'll have to put that in. And there's often a run of rather mundane things for the dungeon to make sense. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it's an ancient temple. There'll be an altar room. Will there be a room where the priests keep the robes, and there'll be a room where, in X-Crawl, there's none of that, because this dungeon has been designed specifically to kill you and challenge you. It doesn't make sense.
It's Death Trap Dungeon. Death Trap Dungeon.
It's Death Trap Dungeon, but I suppose with a modern conceit to explain why you're in a stupid dungeon. Why when you walk through a door, there's a huge troll or ape stood on a platform surrounded by boxes which have useful things in, but they have bells attached to them, and the monkey's blind. The big ape was blindfolded, so to get a parcel you had to move them without making a noise. That's ludicrous, isn't it?
That's
ludicrous in a dungeon, but it's not ludicrous because the idea is it's been designed to be like that. At one point we were on train with a giant Yeti throwing snowballs at us to try and knock the train off the tracks. Totally ridiculous. But it's a futuristic, almost sci-fi design dungeon. So it's still ridiculous. Of course, it is ridiculous. But it's like ridiculous with an explanation as to why it's ridiculous, if that makes sense.
That's good. So it kind of, as you say, the return of the zoo dungeon. It gets rid of the ecology of the dungeon.
It's conceit to get rid of the ecology of the dungeon, so you can just have a madcap fun dungeon, and no one can go, oh, this is just stupid. Well, yeah, it is stupid, but it's been designed to be stupid, the point of it. But I really enjoyed it, and I must admit, I've been, you know, they all have been looking on Leisure Games and thinking, oh, I'm going to end up buying that answer. I'm going to end up buying it. Nothing surer.
Yeah. Well, I like the sound of it, and it sounds like an entertaining convention game. It sounds like it's a perfect...
Mm.
Don't they call them beer and pretzels? I don't particularly like pretzels, but it's that fun pretzels, gathering. But
they're rather boring. I don't like pretzels. I didn't, for a long time, I didn't know what pretzel was. And when I discovered what they were, I thought, oh, is that it? Is that all they are? Yeah. They sound better than they are, don't they? Pretzel. But anyway, there you go. So, I like beer.
One out of the two isn't bad.
Well, you don't have to eat the pretzels, just have the beer.
I revived my Mean Arena game for the Friday night game, which I've run at Albert and Wizard Staff and the Cotton Hoplites. It was a home game for the Manchester team. And to give it a bit of variance, the way that the game works within the game is that there's two racing clocks. I won't go into the details here, but I gave the home team fewer segments to fill because in previous games, it's not been very competitive. The Slater Slayers have defeated the opposition too quickly. And so to make it a bit more exciting, but it still ended up that the Slayers had an emphatic win, even though Andy Burnside, the mayor of Cottonopolis, was trying to throw the game and offered them £500,000 to throw the game.
See, it sounds like X-Crawl. It's a similar kind of idea, isn't it, I suppose? Yeah. There you go.
Themes emerging. Yeah. Maybe there's something in the air that these competitive games are And I ran a couple of games of the Rackless campaign, so little side quests, little convention, it's spin-off shows. You know, like those things that Disney do, where some characters spin off from the main campaign.
Yeah.
And Mark, who plays Mara, managed to do something immediately after. So the campaign that we were running finished in summer. His character does something away from your characters with this group of people that were at the convention, which will change the fate of the campaign. And there was a second one as well that changed. So that was quite fun, even though only I can see what's going on. Once again, my messianic...
Your God complex kicking in.
Only I know what's happening.
You're having more fun than anybody else.
Exactly, as I said last time. But the highlight for me, and this was a surprising highlight because I had to step in and run a game of Liminal and I didn't have anything to hand and I had to do it quite quickly. And I ran your game that you run for us, setting the man inside in Bolton.
You did. Yeah. It's the first time ever that you read my scenario notes, that I've sent you my scenario notes. Felt like you were, I don't know, going out with an ex-girlfriend or something like that, you know.
Yeah. And you write very comprehensive notes. They're very good. And I played the game, so I had an idea of the plot or the sequence of events. And you had all the NPCs and all the information there, what was in scene by scene. And I think I said to you in the morning, having read through it, you're going to have to explain to me why these people are doing these things, because obviously in your own notes you don't need to write that.
Very, very comprehensive notes, but missed out the motivations of these people because that's still in my head. There you go.
Because you don't need that to hand, do you? You don't need, and I kind of remember it from the game we played, but I realised that's appreciate, do you? That's an important component of delivering authentic NPCs is knowing, right, why are they there? What are they doing?
Yeah. And I suppose that's kind of interesting because, like you say, I do write quite comprehensive notes, but I often find the two things. One, I've often talked about this, the thing of I write comprehensive notes and then do not look at them when I'm running the game. I don't look at them, which is weird. It's just like it's putting in my head. Writing it down like that is putting it all in my head somewhere that I can draw it out of a of a filing cabinet in my brain when I need it. But you're right. The other thing is I write comprehensive notes about the things I think I might forget. But as you said, the motivation of the main NPC, for example, in that scenario, I'm not going to forget his motivation, because that's the whole, it's all built around that, isn't it? Yeah. So don't write that down. Yeah. It's a weird, weird thing, isn't it?
It was, they were only ever written for you, weren't they?
They were,
yeah. Me to
come. They were.
But yeah, and it worked really well. And it was the first time that it really hit home to me how good of a system Liminal is. Because there's a final confrontation and it was exciting. And it's the rules that drove it. You know, everyone felt a sense of jeopardy because they were facing something that was quite fearsome. But they managed to overcome it. But I think it really handled that in a very simple way. But it was exciting and thrilling.
Yeah, it is. It's a good system. The way it does the kind of opposed roles, in that they're not really opposed roles, are they? But when you're opposing an opponent, it's their basic role plus their skill. And it makes it, if it's a tough opponent, it makes it very difficult to do any damage to them without spending will. And of course, that will economy as well is something you've got to look out for in the game and consider when you're actually going to spend will and when you're not going to spend it, when you're going to fail and not fail and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a simple game, but it does work very, very well.
And when to activate your special abilities, those really came into the fore, and good tactical use of those at the appropriate time really made the difference. And also, you appreciate, and I think when I ran this previously, I didn't spend enough time thinking about this, is just understanding the powers of the opponent. You've got to really be able to understand what's at their disposal to make it interesting and exciting, because the monsters have particular abilities that can really sway things, can't it? I mean, one of them was, you know, if they were under the thrall of this particular special ability, all will spends were double cost. So that would really change things. Fortunately for them, they managed to resist it. They had enough conviction to resist it, but it would have really scuppered the plans if the will spends were doubled.
Yeah, enough people fall under the spell of someone and you've no will, you're burning will to just get out of it, but then you've none left and you need it. Yeah. No, it is. It is a very good game. And I suppose as well, that's one of the first scenarios I've ever written. I'm trying to think if it is the first that I've built around something local that I know, built around something in my hometown, which I've never really done. You know, it's like when I've run Tales from the Loop, which again is a game that says set it in your hometown. You know, you can do that. I've always set it in Boulder City in America because I just think that's just a convenient remote setting that you can just base your games in. But it was quite interesting to set it in Bolton and set it in the Man's Scythe, and then kind of, I suppose, delve into the history of the Earl of Derby, and a story starts to form in your mind, like an alternative history of what he was really up to and what people were up to and what might have been going on, which of course wasn't what was going on, but it kind of fits together and you write a story around the history, you know, which is kind of really interesting thing to do.
It helped, I think, that one of the players was, his local was the Man and Scythe. People don't know it's one of the oldest pubs in the country, and famously the Earl of Derby had his last meal and drink before he was beheaded outside for his role in the Bolton Massacre, where over 3,000 people were killed. Because we were, I think I mentioned this to Michael Moorcock when he was going about Prince Rupert, but it was a parliamentarian stronghold, wasn't it? We were surrounded by royalists, and Bolton held out.
Yeah, and there was a pub called Prince Rupert around the corner, wasn't there?
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Yeah, he was.
How fickle we could be in Bolton.
How fickle we could be, yes. It's just, when you look at the history, it seems a little bit off colour to have Prince Rupert around the corner from the man's side. Is the where the guy was, one guy was executed for the massacre around the corner, a pub named after the guy who did it. Yeah. But
So overall, it's the first time we've run a grog meet in January. Do you think it worked?
I think it worked. I think we were very lucky with the weather, weren't we?
I think between a snowstorm and an actual storm.
And a hurricane, yeah. The weekend after, no trains were running north of Preston because of the wind, the gale force winds, which would have ruined it, really, wouldn't it? Because no one north of Preston could have come. That would have been it.
Manchester was a lot calmer, wasn't it?
It was, and I think that was a benefit. I mean, I must admit, when I walked into the Lasagarin, I said to you, God, it's busy in here. And you said, no, it's us. It's grog meat. I said, oh, right, okay. But of course, if it had been November, it would have been three times busier than that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a definite advantage in Manchester is a lot quieter than November, just before the Christmas markets, when things are kind of getting busier.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And we have to think about the future because it was a bit tight in the run-up to it. It was a bit difficult preparing it in the middle of December with everything that December brings. But
yeah,
I think that's just the better planning on my behalf, I think.
The tricky thing with it is that Christmas in December, from kind of mid-December, everything seems to grind to a halt. And everyone's mind's elsewhere, and our mind's probably elsewhere as well. So when you pop out the other side of Christmas, you think, oh, it's grog meat in a couple of weeks. Oh, blimey, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, in November, October, November, that's not the case, is it? So there is that. But I suppose you just get used to that, wouldn't you, and just adapt to it, really.
Well, my journey home, I had a chance to reflect upon the weekend for quite some time because I live 35 minutes away from Manchester, but it took me 2.5 hours to get home on a rail replacement bus. Yeah, it's quite an experience.
I remember when you moved to Adlington. I'm going to remind you of this again because it's cruel to remind you of it, but I will do. You moved to Adlington and you said to me, it's going to be great, this. There's a train station just round down the road. There's regular trains straight to Manchester. I could just get on the train, get to Manchester, get back, no problem. And then almost to the day you said that, all that time ago, there's been nothing but chaos on that line. Nothing but chaos.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't help that the guy who was driving the rail replacement bus didn't have a clue where he was going, and he was playing 90s techno music very loudly for the entire journey. So I must have heard the Vengabus, a remix of the Vengabus, about 20 times during the 2 hours. And the length of the journey was extended because he went down, he was following a map and he went down a street. And I said, if you go down here, you're going to end up in an estate and you'll get stuck. You're in a big coach. And he said, sit down, we're not insured for you standing up. And I said, yeah, but you're going the wrong way. Anyway, 20 minutes later, he was having to reverse for a mile because he got stuck. So,
more chaotic than Gatsby and the Great Race. Gatsby and the Great Rail Replacement.
We'll put that down for next year.
Absolutely.
Cheers, Blimey.
Goodbye.
There isn't another bit. Thanks to Paul for being part of a successful grog meet, and thanks to all the GMs who provided games over the weekend, and to the players. It's always a convivial atmosphere, and that's down to the people who come. Thank you. I want to make a special mention of Chris Watkins, who was a keeper for the Gatsby event, and had to make adjustments to his travel plans at the last minute. Above and beyond the call of duty, and at an additional personal expense, I offered to reimburse him for the extra cost, but he, being the kind and gentle person that he is, just wanted me to pass on a message. Chris and Joe from Bonamy Games organise Dice on the Borderlands, a mini-con held at Chepstow Castle, which is just 15 minutes away from the M4-M5 junction. And this year, 2025, the free community RPG event is taking place on the weekend of Saturday, the 10th of May. Booking is essential via Warhorn as space is limited to 7 tables. I've put a link in the show notes with a bit more detail. Thanks for the Patreon support for making Grogmeat possible for another occasion. It is really appreciated. And we've had some new supporters, so next time we're going to delve into Spellbook to give out some magic. If you like what we do, please pass it on. Leave a comment and circulate it on your socials. If you don't like what we do, well, bugger off. Next time, we're extending the idea of Dr. D. Last year we looked at monsters. Why don't we do the same for magic? Until then, adios, amigos.
Absent friends.
Well, I don't take you for lovers of dusty books.
Did the party bore you so quickly? Or is there something here that you hope to find?
You should have stayed downstairs. You should have stayed downstairs. You should have stayed downstairs.
Do you know why I collect these books? Why I host these parties? Everyone thinks it's pretty easy, but it's not. Is for something far greater.
Greater than love?
And something about a lens.
Laid itself bare. Be bent and shaped at will. That's what I've found. And the lens? What does it do? I really must lay traps. The honey badger has been in the outbuilding again. Nuzzling where it should not put its snout.
Beyond anything you can imagine. The stars out there, they're more than pinpricks in the dark.
If that's the price, Mort, then so be it. But I won't be stopped. Not by you. Not by anyone.
Nuzzle, nuzzle! I love the honey badger!